Welcome.
ようこそ。
Bienvenue.
आपका स्वागत है.
Bienvenido.
환영합니다.
Welcome.
Welcome to Keep Connected. I am David Siegel. Today is a special episode with best-selling author Tara Schuster. This is an individual who worked at Comedy Central, who has also written the books Glow in the Fucking Dark, Buy Yourself the Fucking Lilies. It is not going to be all about F words. We promise. Happy listening. Happy learning.Tara, welcome to Keep Connected. You are fucking awesome.
Can you say hello to me all the time? That was like the nicest hello I've ever heard. You are fucking awesome. Thank you for having me.
Now, people might be wondering, David never introduces and says fucking awesome to their guests. Why would he be saying that?
Yeah.
I see that because your previous bestseller is called Buy the Fucking Lilies, and your recently released soon-to-be bestseller, Glow in the Fucking Dark, takes... lots of comfort in that word. So
yes.
You really are an amazing person. I'm so glad to have you. And
yes.
We will throw a couple of F-bombs around, but it will not be with this level of persistence.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to talk to you. When we were chatting before, I was telling you about how I had such a good experience with Meetup doing an event around emotional health during the holidays. And your team was awesome. I was like, I want to be friends. Like, this is its own Meetup. It's preparing for this event. They were so thorough and just kind. One woman, Janine, set me up with a whole other organization. It was just cool. You have good peeps. You got good peeps in your organization.
No, yeah. It really is important because you can't make the shoemaker's children go barefoot. So what I mean by that is Meetup is a kind organization. We focused on ending loneliness. We focus on mental health. We focus on helping introverts, helping people that don't have community. And we look for that in our people. And when we hire people, we make sure to prioritize kindness as part of the priority. And I'm glad you experienced that and hopefully many others will as well.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your story. You've written and talked a lot about having to reparent yourself and your effed up, we'll say, childhood. Share a little context for people. Help people to understand the background story for our listeners. I know this is going to be the absolute first time you've ever told your background story, of course. So try to do it with the zeal and enthusiasm of a first time. Here we go.
It's so funny. This is the first time ever, despite two books that go into this as well. But I mean, basically, you know, not to total mood shift, but I grew up in a house where things came to die. The pets, the animals, it was super neglectful and psychologically abusive. And now when I say all that, I also say, and I don't blame my parents for those circumstances. They were deeply traumatized people who did not have the capacity to learn how to take care of me and my sister. And, you know, what I learned from that experience was the only way I'm going to get attention from adults is to hustle for my worth, to get good grades, to get to an Ivy League college, to get the best job. And oh, isn't this job fancy? And, you know, I ended up at Comedy Central where I was an executive in charge of shows like Key and Peele and working with David Spade and all these fancy people. And
you get to tell lots of people at cocktail parties, oh, I work for Comedy Central. I work with fancy people. I must be very happy and emotionally very healthy.
Yes. And like, I'm in Hollywood. This is so glamorous and fancy. And oh, look at, you know, I only realized recently, like everyone in my past who had sort of known that there was neglect going on, I felt so good being able to say, well, I'm vice president of talent development at Comedy Central.
I made it.
I'm not a weirdo. Aren't you jealous? And my whole identity was tied up in that.
So, how much did you hide neglect?
Yeah.
Versus, and people didn't know and would have been surprised. Versus they looked at me like, oh, poor Tara.
No, none of that. It was a completely hidden. Uh-huh. But now what I know is that you can't completely hide that. It's weird when you're not inviting anybody to your house and when you don't want them to meet your parents and where you're like evading the truth constantly. And actually, I didn't talk about any of this until Buy Yourself the Fucking Lilies came out. So a lot of my friends were like, oh, that makes sense. But I was so ashamed and I was using this high status, I have a great job as my external validation. Like that's all I had was external validation.
Right.
And I might have kept going that way, you know, just looking good on the outside, being good at work, but bad at life, except I was a mess. I was severely anxious and depressed. I mean, I don't really talk about it in the first book, but now I'm willing to. I was flirting with suicidal ideation pretty constantly. It was inside of me, it was like sandpaper on the soul. It was rough and wrong. And I felt 10 out of 10 anxious. And I had a diss track playing in my head. All I could hear was, you're a failure. You're never going to succeed. You're not lovable. No one like all the time.
And all that Tara would have surprised the people around you, or at this point you were getting worse at not as good at hiding it.
I'm the master of hiding my emotions. Nobody knew what was going on at all. I would show up to work as the straight A good daughter of the office, like loyal, and I'm gonna, and look at all these things I did, and isn't this great? And I'm going to get extra credit by going to this like leadership conference that nobody asked me to, you know, just so over the top. And it might have kept going that way had I not, on my 25th birthday, drunk dialed my therapist, threatening to hurt myself. And it's a really particular kind of shame when you wake up and realize that's what happened, because I listened back to her voicemails. That's how I even knew. I looked at my phone. I'm like, why is my doctor calling me? So weird. What's up, doc? Like Saturday night. And I listened back, and in her messages, she was getting increasingly worried to find me, get me to go to a hospital, get me to be with someone. And it wasn't until I heard the worry in her voice that I started worrying about myself. And I thought, wow, if I don't do something to save my life, there's not going to be much more of a life left for me. And really that morning, so hungover in my Forever 21 sequined number, I just got serious and said to myself, I didn't have parents. I don't have anyone to nurture me. I do not have wise mentors. I don't have a support system. I've got to figure this out now. And it was with a real urgency. And so I decided I got to reparent myself. And that wasn't a term when I started this project. I just knew I needed to go back and unlearn so much. Like, that's why reparent, like I had to unlearn a bunch, and then I knew that I'd have to learn a lot. And so I just started a Google Doc, because of course I was such a worker bee. We do everything with a Google Doc, even mental health. And I just wrote all the questions I had, you know, what are values? What are principles? What are vegetables? Like, genuinely, what are they? Which ones should I be eating? Which I still have that question. I feel like Instagram's always telling me it's one thing and then another. I feel like we should understand this better at this point in the civilization. But I did this for 5 years. At the end, I had a 600-page Google Doc and felt like a completely different person. You know, I read memoir as self-help. I sought out adults to teach me, people I really respected and admired. It was a constant battle.
Your journey is way you describe it here is incredibly self initiated. And did you go to either a facility or a hospital or seek any kind of more formal process for therapy, aside from obviously the therapist that you're going to, or really you kind of created, you chose your own adventure to a large extent in your way?
Yeah, this is a mystery about me. I'm what the writer Gretchen Rubin would describe as an upholder, which means I don't need any I'm always hustling for external validation, but I'm the one doing it. Right. I don't need encouragement.
Very initiative taking.
Yeah, I'll just do it. That's a gift my parents gave me. I'm sure that's part
of their
personality.
Which they had to do to survive to some extent.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that's like my little survivor voice is just, if I didn't do everything I did to get out of that house and to get myself tools for mental health, you know, I wouldn't be here today. So it was all like self-led, but I found incredible mentors in the books of Nora Ephron or Steve Martin. I just soaked up everything. And at the end of 5 years, I felt stable for the first time ever, which emotional stability seemed impossible. Content some days, like some days, just not worried and spiraling. That was a huge, momentous achievement. And that's when I realized, oh, hold on, I have a whole guidebook. Like, I have 600 pages of this journey. I wonder if this would be helpful for anyone else. I would have really liked a book like this when I was going through what I was going through. So really, Buy Yourself the Fucking Lilies is an offering of, hey, you don't need to have had as neglectful a childhood as I had, but we all have holes. Like, even the best of parents who nurtured the shit out of you, they can't do everything. They're humans. So this book is really for anybody who is looking to fill in some holes, looking to learn how to self-nurture. That's what Buy Yourself the Fucking Lilies is all about. And that's the briefest version of how I can talk about my backstory.
Do you have a relationship with either of your parents today?
Yes. So I have an extremely close relationship with my dad now, but it's only because, so I had this Comedy Central job and that was my status. I got laid off at the beginning of the pandemic. And with it, I had a complete identity crisis. You know, people introduced me, Tara Schuster, Comedy Central, like it was my married last name. You know, that's who I was.
Yeah, it was your total identity.
Completely. And right. When I lost that job and lost that identity, all of my worst traumas, which I had really suppressed, mm-hmm. came bubbling to the surface because no one else was defining me. I didn't have a schedule to be on. And these things wanted to be dealt with.
Right. And you define yourself by external versus internal. And that's the problem with losing the external.
Exactly. And I really wondered, do we have an essential self? Is there something more to me? I had realized so much of my life has been a reaction to trauma, not a proactive decision about who I am. And so one of the things I did was I stopped talking to my dad. Actually. And I hadn't talked to my mom in 15 years. Or maybe it's 15 years now. I don't have any relationship with my mom. Okay. But with my dad, I realized I love my dad. I need space. If I'm mm-hmm. really going to heal these darkest wounds, I cannot have him on my mind. I had taken care of his emotions for so long. I can't do this. And so I stopped talking to him. And then he got COVID. And I found this out from my sister and I thought, oh, whatever, doesn't matter. I'm going to help him. And when I went to help him, I found out the craziest thing of all, which was he had gone to therapy every week of those 2 years to answer the question, why is my daughter not speaking to me?
Wow. Wow.
And he was, I'm not exaggerating at all, 180% different. He thanked me if I helped him, you know, through COVID.
I mean, how old is your dad at that time?
78.
Right. So that's just a message that I want our listeners to hear, which is people oftentimes think of therapy for teenagers or for 20 somethings. I'm figuring out life. I don't know what to do. But to have that kind of transformation at 78 years old and be 180 degree different person in the ways that you want to be different, I find that incredibly motivating as someone who's a middle-aged person, you know, not quite 78 myself. And I think it's really important for people to kind of realize that as well. So keep going, please.
Yeah. Well, the reason I tell that story is, you know, how I don't want that story interpreted is if you set a boundary, someone will change. That's rarely the case. Though I think boundary setting is really important. The point of that, of even sharing a detail like that, is that we all have more agency than we think. Mm. And there really isn't a moment where it's too late. And if you were to talk to my dad today, he would say that he's glad. It was very painful for him, mm-hmm. but he is glad that I stopped talking to him mm-hmm. because, and I write about in this book, he feels like a human for the first time ever. He feels like he's going to get to live a life. And it's, you know, there's a sorrow to that.
Yeah. That at 78 that he feels that.
Yeah. And a sorrow to me of, oh my God, I have a dad for the first time ever. Why couldn't it have been like this much sooner? And it takes the time it takes.
Listen, for a lot of people, it never happens.
Yeah.
They pass away and it doesn't happen. So
totally.
Hopefully many years he has left is a gift and it'll be a gift for the two. So you talk regularly now. It sounds
yes.
like you and your father and you talk about your books and you talk about your talks and you talk about the past.
Totally.
He must be just beyond proud of you.
Yeah. He's very proud. And, you know, people get really afraid about honesty. you know, if we talk about this, then it's going to be so much worse. I don't want to talk about this. And what I learned through this whole journey is it was the secrecy that was rotting everything, you right. know. But once I had the books, my dad actually on paper could validate. He was like, everything in here happened. I'm sorry. Like, it forced him to look at the situation, I think, more objectively and more from my eyes, how that would have felt. So if anything, our relationship is millions of times better mm-hmm. than it ever was. I would write the books all over again simply for that, to be closer to my dad.
So you wrote your next book, Glow yes. in the Fucking Dark. There yes. is a fucking series going on here.
Yeah. So when I lost the job, I did not take a moment to reflect. I didn't say, huh, I'm well-resourced. I can take 2 seconds and think about this. I thought, I need meaning now. I need to be busy right now. I need to be doing – I mean, that's how I dealt with everything, was hustle, produce, make. And so it was –
Well, as long as you don't have to think, it's always easier. Because exactly. if you're doing lots of stuff, you don't have to think. So that works.
Exactly. And that job had been a full-time, 24-hour, I'm on. I'm so passionate about, you know, this job. So I needed something to replace it. And it was 2020, so I just Googled, how can I help in the 2020 election? You know, I was like, this is a big deal. This is what I'll do. And like, essentially the first search result was, you can help register voters in Arizona. Just like that, I grabbed my Vitamix and like, you know, a bag full of books that I would never read, hopped in my Prius of doom, and I moved to Arizona. And on en route, somewhere in the Mojave Desert between Los Angeles and Flagstaff, I had a full body dissociative episode, which if you haven't had one, it's your mind is trying to shut down any traumatic memories, anything you don't want to think about. And it does. It like represses, but it makes your body feel like it's not present, like you don't feel present. And so, you know, I could see my hands on the steering wheel. I could see like my shoddy self-done manicure, but it was like they were floating. And it was like they weren't mine. And I felt full body sick, like all of my insides could come up. And I also felt out of control. I was going 95 and didn't know. I was having trouble thinking how to stop. And if you know me, I'm not a good enough driver to be going 95 anywhere, much less in the middle of the desert having this episode. And so for the first time in my life, I realized I have to pull over. I cannot keep hustling my way through life. I can't keep overwhelming my way through life. This doesn't work and it feels awful. And now I'm endangering my own life.
And pulling over wasn't just physically pulling over.
It's no.
Metaphorically pulling over as well.
It's like my soul's got to rest. I can't. Right. I just cannot keep doing this. And so I pulled over and it was nighttime. And in the Arizona desert, it looked like I was just surrounded by a star field. I was just like, glowing stars everywhere. And maybe that's because LA, we have so much pollution that you're like, that's a star. And then someone's like, no, it's a satellite. Like, we have no stars. So I was standing there looking at these and I wondered, it is so dark out here. And 2020, it is such a dark world in this moment. I have no control. I've got no control over that. So is there a place within me that can glow just like these stars do?
You know, what's interesting is that stars glow due to stress and due to pressure.
Yes.
And that stress and pressure is actually good in creating yes. the glowing. And yes. it's similar to us humans, which I just listened to something in a podcast and talked about the importance of having small negatives and small pressures and small stress in order to avoid big negatives and big pressures and big stress.
Yes.
And pressure and stress is actually a very positive thing because it moves you to the right direction as long as it's something that one can handle. So,
and it's unavoidable, like good or bad. You are going to be stressed and pressured and it's going to happen over and over again and you have no control. And so really the only question here is, how do you find internal safety? How do you stop being moved by the wind, you know, every time there's a gust? That's all we have control over.
Beautiful. So one of the things that I read about that you write and read about, which I thought was just really well said, is about silencing your inner frenemy and kind of mm-hmm. shielding yourself from self-criticism and the importance of it. It's so important. I just want to pull it out. And can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think it's just everyone suffers from this to varying degrees, and just help us to understand it a little more.
Absolutely. So I was addicted to self-criticism. It was truly all I could hear was this running diss track, which was grinding me down, because it's really hard to dream or to live or to be happy if you are that negative about yourself. And so for me, I knew that was happening. And one of the first tools I was ever introduced to is journaling, as a way to just even see what was going on in my interior. And I'm so sorry to say this, but I've been journaling for more than a decade now, and it
600
works.
600 pages.
Yeah, it works. Like, it more than anything.
Why are you sorry to say this?
Because it's so annoying. Who wants to journal? It's terrible. I'm
sorry to ask. Do you handwrite your journaling, or do you type your journaling? You handwrite. Yeah. Is it a different experience? Because I know you talk about journaling a lot, to write by hand versus to type. Because I was talking to a family member of mine, and I said to her, you know, it's so important to journal. And she's like, I've never written anything in my life. You know, younger generation, I should, I would type. So what's the advice here? Is typing okay or not?
I think anything that gets you to journal is great. So it'd be the first thing. I do think there's an added benefit to writing, because your mind and body have to unite to do something physical. Mm. And the whole, I think one of the most beautiful things about journaling is you get out of your mind and onto the page. Like, basically, like how I do it is I word vomit 3 pages every morning, which is taken from Julia Cameron's fabulous book, The Artist's Way.
Without stopping, without thinking.
Without thinking. Yeah. Because you're not really even writing. It's more like you're venting. You're not like reporting on what happened yesterday. You're asking yourself, how do I feel? Which is something most of us actually do not take any time to think about, nor know any of the vocabulary for. And so I was journaling all the time, and I just saw how little I thought of myself, how doomed I felt. And that was like, so mind-blowing to see that. But what was great was on the page, you can really deal with those things. So I realized, okay, I have this voice within me. It's not quite my own voice. It's my frenemy within, somebody I've just known forever, like an old camp friend who I wouldn't be friends with today. You know, like if we met, I would not want to hang out with them.
We all have them.
We got history, you know? So I keep my frenemy within around. And I needed to figure out how to let her be quiet a little bit more of the time. And so what I did was I would write down everything she was saying about me, like, here are all the fictions she's saying about me. And I'd put a column down a piece of paper. And then on the other side, I would write the facts. You know, what else is true? Is it true that I'm going to be unloved and never find romantic love and never have a partner? Or is it true that I have so much love in my life and I've succeeded at literally everything I've ever tried once I put some effort into it? And why would this be any different? And if I keep holding this attitude, aren't I just going to make things much, much worse? You know, so you're just able to parse things out. Or sometimes I'd write a letter to my frenemy within, refuting all the charges and defending myself.
Wow. Incredible. Okay. So you would acknowledge the criticism first.
Yes.
That's step one. It's not disregarding, it's acknowledging it.
And
not just acknowledging verbally, but documenting it.
Yes.
And then finding ways to combat that criticism. Some of it you'd say, actually, that's true. And some of it you say, it's not so true.
Absolutely.
And that just was a way to understand which things to truly be self-critical about and which things, hopefully, in the majority of things, not to necessarily be and not to be as obsessed.
And one of the things you said at first is paramount, which is don't dismiss these things.
Right.
We often think, oh, well, I know intellectually that's not a real thing, and so I'm not going to deal with it. But that's the problem, is we're not dealing with it. We're just like pushing it to the side. And whatever that little voice is, it wants to be heard. So if you dismiss it, it's going to keep coming back tenfold, because it wants you to hear something. And now I would take it a step further and say, I've realized you can't reject your way to self-acceptance. You actually kind of have to love those parts of yourself.
I love it.
You know,
because you can't change a lot of the things you can't change. You can harness in the right way.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't necessarily change who you are internally.
No, but you for sure, what I've realized is those voices now work with me, not against me. I cannot describe. I really, it's unbelievably different for me now, how I walk around in the world. I largely don't criticize myself. I largely just say, oh, I noticed that. How interesting. Let me work with that feeling. Because through all these practices that I describe in my second book, Glow in the Fucking Dark, like meditation, which I try to explain in a less annoying way than most people talk about meditation, or journaling, or any of the practices, they give you more space within you. They're things that help you manage your emotions so you're less easily overwhelmed. You know, it's not that I don't get anxious anymore. For sure I do. It's that it's not the only thing. It doesn't like hook in and overwhelm.
And when you do, you have a number of different actions that you can take. So I was talking to a friend recently who gets anxious. And one of the things that she said to me was what she does is she experiences all five of the senses and just takes a pause. Oh, yeah. It grounds her. And I think everyone experiences some levels of anxiety. It's a question of how you handle that anxiety when you're getting it. You talked a little bit about meditation and journaling. One of the things you write quite a bit about is kind of the morning time and one's practice in the morning. I'm a big morning person. Not everyone is, I think, as lucky as me to really love the morning. And part of it is that I want to get as many things as I can that are important to be done during the day. So I know that if I get them done in the morning, I don't have to worry about and think about whether I'm going to be able to get them done in the evening and have that stress. Talk a little bit about your mornings.
Yeah.
What do they look like? What do you want them to look like?
Yeah. Well, I have another apology, which is I'm sorry that it works to be a morning person. No one is more sorry than I am. I hated the mornings. I would get up. I mean, I was like a total night owl. I'm going to comedy shows for my job, you know? So I'm not getting home until like 1-2 in the morning.
Comedy writers are not known to wake up at 5 a.m. and go to sleep
by 10. No, not at all. No schedule. And what I realized, though, is exactly what you're saying, is that I have priorities for me that have nothing to do with my job or who I am externally. And if I don't do them in the morning, they're not going to get done because the world takes its toll. The world, you know, demands things of you, your partner, your kids, your boss, you know, whatever. And so for me, what my mornings look like are I wake up at 6:30 every morning. I first thing I do is meditate for 20 to 30 minutes. That's just, I find that's a really good way just to begin, is like, let's just be grounded and like chill for a minute, or at least alone but conscious for 1 minute. Let's do that. Then I journal for about an hour. But for me, that's it's really 20 minutes of journaling and 40 minutes of writing.
Right.
Good. It's just, so 20 minutes would be is great. And it's just, you know, word vomiting everything. And then I exercise.
You haven't eaten anything yet? No coffee? You haven't eaten?
Well, I'm on an intermittent fasting schedule. So, but I definitely have coffee. Coffee. And I mean, if I were to even get more granular, it's like, get out of bed, put the blinds down, brush my teeth. Like, it's like a whole order so that one thing follows the next. Right. So it's not like confusing.
Like, people say this to me, my mornings are like Groundhog Day.
Oh, they're all the same.
Every single morning, if you looked at my morning, especially the last 2 years, certainly since COVID started, we're really got consistent. It's like, go downstairs, make my athletic greens, drink my athletic greens, empty the dishwasher. It's just one after another, just totally consistent.
Yes. I find that my life, my schedule is very boring, which means I can be very creative and risky in other parts of my life because I feel so secure and grounded in those things that creatively – I'm not so scared anymore.
No, but I love that for people whose every day they wake up and they think, what am I going to do today? That's scary.
Oh, yeah. I it's so soothing to have a ritual like that. Yeah. And the other big thing is I don't look at my phone for the first hour that I'm conscious.
Amazing.
It is a game changer. Yeah. Until you start doing it and then you're like, oh, my God, my life is like immeasurably better because I didn't get sucked down an Instagram or doom spiral. I wasn't looking at a screen first thing. I was with me. I mean, truly, 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 if you wanted to jumpstart your whole self-care routine, you would sleep with the phone, not in your room, and you would not look at it for the first hour that you're awake. It's horrible. Terrible. Hard.
I do the first. My wife does not let us have our phone in our room. So it's in our guest room. We keep it outside.
Yeah.
Second is a little more difficult because I like to look at my little morning newsletters while I'm having my breakfast, but I'm gonna see if it's possible.
Just see. Just try.
Yeah, I love that their morning ritual. That is amazing. And so many people can learn from it. And if they know, they don't need to copy what you do. They need to figure out what the right thing is for them. And they can be inspired by some of the things that you do. But having a ritual, it's incredibly helpful. I have so many questions, but two more. Here we go. Brené Brown, Glennon Doyle. I saw that you actually know Glennon, and you've done some things with her together. You know, everyone talks about kind of bearing it all. You were someone who didn't share nearly anything about yourself. There's so many people who are listening who also are in a similar place. And Brené Brown and Glennon Doyle share it all, right? They share it all. They also hadn't shared much at various times in their life. How hard was it for you in the beginning? Harder than you thought it would be, or actually easier than you thought it would be?
It wasn't hard at all. And I often wonder what's wrong with me, because actually people would ask me this question. How hard is it? You're so vulnerable on the page. You're telling everybody everything. And I'm like, wait, this wasn't normal. I should be scared. Wait, what? That's what freaked me out, was like, I didn't even realize to be scared about it. It just felt so natural. But what I would say is something I learned from Glennon Doyle, which is the stories that we're telling are actually not that personal. Like, I only will write a story if it feels like there's a more universal truth and I'm just using my details so you can see it through my eyes and maybe it resonates. But they're things that everybody can relate to, and they feel different when I write them. If it's too personal and about me and it's not healed, I can tell. It's like just a weird, different vibration to the writing.
Makes sense. And it's not something people can gain and learn from.
No. So I only write something if I'm interested in it and I think it would be helpful to other people. If those are the two questions I always ask. If it's something else, like I'm ranting or I'm venting or like this happened and I need to figure it out on paper, that's not something I would include in a book.
Right. It's healthy still to do.
Yeah. Oh, totally. In my journal. But there's a difference between my own journal and my own writing. One is deeply, deeply personal. The other is I'm using personal stories to tell a universal truth.
I have to ask it because I'm just wondering, based on the way that you were parented and your unparenting and experiences, do you want to have kids?
Such a good question. I am very ambivalent about if I want to have kids or not. I actually write in Glow about my own. I didn't know what I wanted, and I was 35. And, you know, a lot of 35-year-old women around me were like, you should freeze your eggs. Give yourself more options. And enough people said it. I was completely ambivalent. Like, I don't know. But enough people said it that I just thought, well, for future me, who has a better understanding of all of this, future me, who is more healed, she might want more options. And since I don't really know, let me do this. And also, I had an expiring insurance benefit, and I love a deal. So
it's expensive, apparently.
Oh,
it's incredibly expensive.
It's insanely expensive. So I knew I was going to get a steep discount. So I cannot resist.
Can't turn down a deal. Some people like to go to the discount shopping, and you like to go to discount
healthcare. Education. Yeah. Yes. So I actually did freeze my eggs and go through. It was a pretty terrible process that I want to tell people about, and I do in the book. Because I don't know. Yeah, I don't know if I want to have kids. I have no clue. So
I love that, because like you said, you're a very different person at late 30s than you were in early 20s than you were in early teens. And you could be a very different person in your early to mid 40s than you are now. So I think that's creating that option for yourself. Certainly prudent, and it's good that you got the discount. Some potential great names to name your kid if it happens, you know.
Yes.
Cut, discount, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Many good options there. Exactly.
Here we go. Rapid fire questions, rapid fire answers. Are you ready?
I think so. Let's try.
First time you saw yourself as a leader?
At Comedy Central, when I started having meetings that people would come up to me and say, well, that wasn't miserable. Thanks for calling me out. Thanks for the praise. I was like, oh, I'm changing our culture a little at this office.
Nice. So important. If you could access a time machine, go anywhere in the world at any time, where, when are you going?
I would go to New York, I believe the Upper West Side, to the 1990s to meet Nora Ephron and have coffee or arugula or something like that with her. She's my favorite author, my favorite director, just like icon. There's like a picture of her above my computer staring at me at all times. So it'd be to meet her and just to hear her talk. Like, I don't even know that I have questions. I just want to hear her opinion on everything.
Chocolate or strawberry arugula?
Chocolate, duh. Chocolate, please.
No cinnamon or strawberry.
No,
for you. Our listeners are like, what's arugula? Look it up. You could Google it if you're outside the US. Name one thing on your bucket list.
I want to go to Patagonia. I've been to Buenos Aires. I took a long solo vacation there, but I wasn't brave enough to go to Patagonia. And now I'm just like, I got to get there. It sounds amazing.
Can you see the penguins?
I want to see everything. Yeah.
It's supposed to be incredibly beautiful. I have not been myself, but one day we'll go together on health.
One day. Yes.
Last question. You've done so many things. You're not even halfway done with, you're third done with your life. Not even yet. What do you most want to be remembered by?
I want to be remembered that people felt like they were seen when I talked to them, that they felt special when I talked to them, that I was like really present with people. That's what I want to be remembered for.
Amazing. Well, I felt that you were very present in the conversation.
Thank you
so much. Thank you for taking the time to be on Keep Connected. I feel connected to you, and hopefully many of our listeners feel the same.
Thank you for having me. This was fabulous.
Thanks for listening to Keep Connected with Tara Schuster as today's guest. What an exceptional individual. Some takeaways. The power of the morning ritual, whether it's meditation, exercise, yoga, whatever that is, not listening and interacting with social media, very powerful. Her identification, not as her job, not as these externalities, but understanding who she truly is. And finally, the importance of internal safety versus self-criticism. If you enjoyed today's podcast, then remember, subscribe, leave a review, and let's keep connected. Because life, better together. David Siegel here, your favorite podcast host. I have something important to share. Check out my new book, Decide and Conquer, to really get to know my story at Meetup. You know, the hardest thing about community leadership is making tough decisions when the stakes are high. And I'll tell you, they were never higher than when Meetup was owned and sold by WeWork. In my new book, Decide and Conquer, I'll walk you through a counterintuitive framework for decision-making and the epic journey of Meetup's surprising survival. Good leaders deliberate, great leaders decide. Order my book today by visiting decideandconquerbook.com or anywhere books are sold. Think you'll like it.